name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, because the two words, Ar-Rahman and Rahim, especially in this context, are very much related to the theme I was chosen for you this year, that is the theme of forgiveness, because it deals with the divine mercy. I'm very glad to be able to be here with you this afternoon. I want to thank the President and Professor Haido for making this possible, and to thank them for their hospitality. I shall speak for time allotted and also give you a little bit of time to ask any questions that you may have. I'm sure many questions will come up. The theme of forgiveness, of course, is a very vast subject, and I chose specifically as the subject of my discourse today, mercy and forgiveness, justice and judgment, an Islamic perspective. Because to speak of forgiveness except sentimentally will never be sufficient unless one also considers the question of justice, both divine and human, and where is it that we can apply the principle of mercy, and where is it that we have to apply the principle of justice. It's a very, very crucial matter. There's no religion in the world, no integral religion, whether it be Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, or other great religions of the world, in which to ask the both question and answers, both keys and means of forgiveness, are not present. I would claim that in every religion, even in a religion like Buddhism or Confucianism, in which there is no personal divinity like we have in the Abrahamic religions, like Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, there is the question of forgiveness and the importance of forgiveness and its spiritual efficacy. Coming back to Islam itself, I have to clear the ground of a certain misunderstanding that has become prevalent in the West concerning Islam when it comes to this issue, and really goes back to old missionary writings centuries back, and that is to claim that the concept of God in Islam, Allah, only deals with the God of justice, that the Muslims have no idea of the God of mercy and therefore of forgiveness. This, of course, is totally fallacious, totally false. Of the 114 chapters of the Quran, which is the sacred scripture of Islam, all except one begin with the words, in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, not the just or the punisher. God appears also in the Old Testament as judge, as the dispenser of justice, and as giver of death, and all of the other names of wrath that are connected with the divinity. It also appears in the Quran with those attributes, but that does not exhaust the divine reality in the same way that the wrath of God does not exhaust the divine reality for Jews, nor does it for Christians. And for some Christians to claim that but that's Judaism and Christianity, God is only love, then why is there justice? Where does justice come from? And great Christian theologians have answered that by saying that, yes, love predominates in God, but God's justice is also part of the divine reality. So ultimately, we come down to the same thing. All great religions of the world emphasize the aspect of the divine mercy from which comes forgiveness, and all pardon, repentance, all that goes with it, and the aspect of justice related to law, related to judgment, without which there would be no world. Each thing has to observe its own limits in order for the world to be what it is. If the earth under me right now were stopped being the earth and started shaking, I could not speak before you. Everything has its own measure. And morally, that means there must be justice related to everything in the world. In Islamic theological context, and I don't want to talk heavily about heavy matters in this this afternoon, but nevertheless I have to touch upon it lightly. God is described by a number of divine names, by names. Obviously, the very concept of name is very central to religion. Otherwise, the Lord's Prayer, which is the prayer recited by Christians, which was enunciated by Christ himself, does not say, "Hallowed be thy name." Why thy name? Name is very, very essential in the understanding of religion in the Abrahamic context and also in other religions, because it's identified in an inner mysterious way with God himself. The name of God or the name of divine reality, the name of anything has an inner relationship with that thing, but especially the divine being who's all consciousness, all presence, and who's everywhere. Now there are asma, in Arabic plural of is, names of God. The Quran itself says to God belong the most beautiful names. Call him by these names. وَلِلَّهَ الْأَسْمَاءُ الْحُسْنَى. So the naming of calling upon God through his names is a very, very important part of Islamic life and Islamic practice. And those names of God are not names that we have given to God according to Muslims, but the names that God has revealed for us himself through his sacred text, sacred book, which is the Quran. Now, these names are usually divided into the names of beauty and the names of majesty. Asma'ul Jalal and Asma'ul Jamal. Majesty implies law, order, judgment, justice. Like a king has to be just in order for the kingdom to survive. Whereas the names of beauty involve precisely beauty, love, mercy, forgiveness. You might say the feminine aspect of the divinity, if we understand feminine and masculine in their purely spiritual sense, not only biological sense, in contrast to what many modern biologists and thinkers claim, it is not human beings who have abstracted from the genders an idea of divine femininity and divine masculinity. Masculinity and femininity themselves are manifestations of a divine reality, which has both a masculine and feminine element. And anyway, the names of beauty, which are full, mentioned over and over again in the Quran, the Quran is full of it, the Quran is full of them on many pages, and they include the whole series of names, but two of them pertain especially to the subject of this year's program that you have in this college. One is the name Ghafur, which in Arabic means forgiver. God is the forgiver. Ghafur. That's one of the 99 names of God. We can call upon God as the forgiver. And many Muslims do. And the other is Afu. That is he who pardons. God is the pardoner. The two names are very, very close to each other. And therefore, from the Islamic point of view, the attribute of forgiveness originally comes from God. For Muslims to forgive is try to emulate a divine quality. So therefore, it's something very worthy, religiously speaking. And there are hundreds and hundreds of sayings of the Prophet of Islam concerning this issue and that of great saints and sages of Islam after him. Now, there are two very different aspects of forgiveness. Classical Islamic thought has been very much aware of this. One is in relation to God, and one is in relation to God's creation. These two are very, very different. Again, to refer to the Lord's Prayer, because most of you are either Christians or come from Christian background. I cannot give examples from Hinduism or something like that, but I think that this still resonates with many people. the believer asks of, or Christ himself first asks of God, to forgive our trespasses, and you forgive others who have trespassed against us. One is asking God for two very different things. One concerns oneself, one concerns the other. In the Islamic perspective, this can be understood in the following way. The word, an Arabic word called huquq, H-U-Q-U-Q. This has many, many cognates and related terms. The word haq in Arabic, which means truth and reality, which is one of the names of God, is related to this. A law school would be called the school of huquq, or as law. It also means right, one's right. And duty towards the rights of others. All of the ra'aya who allow to be attentive to the rights of others. These are all contained in this remarkable Arabic word, which is really not completely translatable into a single term in English. So let me just stick to the Arabic for a moment without burdening you too much. According to Islamic thought, There is huquq Allah and huquq al-nas. That is, the rights of God and the rights of human beings, of His creation. God has certain rights over us, and His creation has certain rights over us. And when we transgress those boundaries and we neglect those rights, the element of forgiveness comes in. That to which we have no relation whatsoever, toward which we have no responsibility whatsoever, towards which we cannot act whatsoever, we can neither forgive that thing or that being, nor be forgiven. It has no meaning. Forgiveness implies already some kind of relationship, some kind of reciprocity of relationship. So let me start with the divine aspect. With God's rights. God, according to Islam, of course, to all religions, has created us. We haven't created God. There is no equality in the act of being. Atheists believe that human beings have invented God. But religious people believe that it's God who has made us. So it's the source of our being. And since the source of being, it is He who gives and we who receive. And therefore, from the human point of view, there's nothing to forgive God for. An authentic, correct, spiritual attitude could never claim and say, "Oh God, I forgive thee because you didn't give me two Cadillacs and gave my neighbor two Cadillacs." This is absurd. This is not the correct spiritual attitude, and all religions have spoken against this. It is because God doesn't owe us anything. It is we who owe everything to God. The only thing God owes us in a very deep philosophical sense is having given us the power of approaching to Him, approaching unto Him, to give Himself to us. As God has allowed us to approach Him, He owes us also the possibility of having this approach have an end unto itself. But that's a very subtle metaphysical issue that I will not get into. But in the ordinary human sense, we owe everything to God. God owes nothing to us. And therefore, forgiveness, as far as God is concerned, is a one-way affair. It is we who ask God's forgiveness. And how God forgives and who He forgives is not for us to determine. This is one of the great problems of history, of human beings in all society. In societies in which religion is very weak, other problems exist. But in societies in which religion is strong, with religion comes the idea some people have of self-righteousness. That is, they know better than God what is good for things, and what is good for us, and what is good for God. They know whom God forgives and whom God does not forgive. This is, of course, a blatantly wrong spiritual attitude, and Islam has always traditionally kept itself open on this issue of who is forgiven and who is not forgiven. How does the divine forgiveness function, and how does it accord with human action? The door is kept open. The Quran keeps warning people about doing wrong things, that they will be punished for it. But then it also says, وَلَا تَقْنَتُوا مِنْ رَحْمَةِ اللَّهِ. Never lose hope in the mercy and forgiveness of God. So the idea of asking God's forgiveness is, according to Islam, a door that is always open to human beings as long as they are alive. We have today in the Islamic world the phenomenon that it also exists in other religions, as Hinduism and Judaism and Christianity in different ways, of people who do not want to who want to close God's forgiveness towards others, who decide who is damned and who is not on behalf of God. This is a pretty modern attitude, interestingly enough. If you really look at it, it's much more prevalent today than it was centuries ago. It is true that Christianity is a special case, but in Christianity, Christians believe that salvation only comes through Christ. Christ is the only Son of God, it's the only gate towards God, so anyone who does not accept Christ is damned to hell. That is, on the, of course, understood on that level. But on a personal level, even in medieval Europe, where there was so much opposition to Islam, in a place like Spain, many Christians had a much more open attitude toward Muslims than so-called fundamentalists today of either Christianity or Islam have against each other or about each other. So this has become a very major problem. That is our determining even God's power of forgiveness. Forget about our own forgiveness. We will decide for God whom he can forgive and whom he cannot forgive. This, I believe, is a very dangerous idea which tries to curtail the divine power ultimately, which is one of the major problems of our world. Because God is infinite mercy, and because he is the forgiver, he also wants us to ask forgiveness of him. There's a very enigmatic hadith that is saying of the Prophet of Islam, in which God addresses the Prophet in the first person. He said, and he says to him, he said, "You know, if there were to be humanity that never transgressed, whose members never transgressed, who did not commit sin, and who did not have to ask forgiveness of me, what I would do? I would destroy that humanity and create a humanity who would say, 'Astaghfirullah,' that is, 'I ask forgiveness of thee.'" It's a very, very enigmatic hadith, how God says such a thing. What it means, what this hadith means, is that God, being the forgiver, he wants to forgive. The fact that God is the creator, he creates the world. The very power of being creator, the result of it is the putting into action of this divine power, which is creativity and the creation of the world, and many other attributes of God. And the fact that God is Al-Ghafoor, is the forgiver, he wants us to ask forgiveness of him. And therefore, one of the most famous prayers in all of Islam, in Islamic piety, in everyday life of Muslims, is the formula, Astaghfirullah. That is, I ask forgiveness of God, or I ask pardon of God. The word Istighfar here in Arabic is the 10th form, as they use the Latin alphabet grammar to study Arabic. And it means to pull out, and the meaning that is to seek, to bring out the power of God's forgiveness. And therefore, Safrullah is one of the most famous formulas that is used throughout a Muslim's life, especially when a Muslim feels that he has transgressed beyond the boundary of something. And the idea of transgression, of going beyond boundaries, going beyond the hukuk of things, brings with it a Safrullah. But now to turn to an-nas, insan, human beings. And here, ultimately, without including animals, I should say something about that, and even plants in a moment. But let's stick to human beings. When we discuss the theme of forgiveness, not vis-a-vis the Creator, where there's a one-way street, you might say, God forgives, and we demand His forgiveness. In the human realm, on the human plane, there is, of course, this reciprocity that is both to forgive and to be forgiven. The first question that comes up is that if this reciprocity exists, and if it has such an effect upon the soul, which I shall mention in a moment, why is it that God has left it to us? It's a very important question to ask. That is, He has given us the freedom to forgive or not forgive. He has also given us the freedom to accept forgiveness from others or not accept. Almost all of us, some of you are very young, perhaps not yet, but those who are a bit older, have faced in life a situation both ways, in which you have a freedom of choice of forgiving A for something that he or she has done, but one just can't get oneself to do it. One doesn't want to do it. Or we feel that a grievous fault has occurred, terrible thing, somebody has done to us, and then he asks forgiveness. We don't want to accept it. So there's both a passive and active element to forgiveness. Both the giving of forgiveness and the accepting of forgiveness. Why is it that we are free to do this? Why is it that God has left such a big responsibility on our shoulder? This is a problem of really religious and mystical psychology. And it's a very profound problem, and I cannot really, in just a lecture like this, get more than a certain amount into it. But I will say a few words about it. Both forgiving and not forgiving affects the human soul. It's almost like pouring water on fire. Anyone who has performed even a simple act of forgiveness feels a simple sense of release, of freedom. One is freed from grudge, from hatred, from being tied up and bound up by one's hatred of something. So forgiveness is a way for the soul to gain freedom. And therefore, if a soul were really aware enough of its ultimate self-interest, not shallow self-interest, would always forgive when it could. Would always forgive, because it's to its own benefit. Otherwise, you have to carry this burden of grudge or hatred or opposition on something on your back all your life. And therefore, it's a very important instrument for the purification of the soul. It's precisely because of this that God has left it to us. Because the responsibility for being good is on our own shoulders. All religions, including Islam, which is oftentimes blamed for being disharmonistic and against free will, ultimately, when it comes to practice, they believe that we are free to be good or not good. The theological position you can find in every religion, between John Calvin and St. Thomas Aquinas on the question of free will and determinism, you have two polar positions in Christianity, and Islam also has all these positions, the polar ones and everything in between. But then, practically speaking, if we are not free to be good or evil, no amount of either reward or punishment from God no expectation, no responsibility will have any meaning. Morality without free will is just a wordplay. It's just a wordplay. There are those who deny free will on biological basis, on mechanical basis, on psychological basis, like Freud and others. But the religious people, even if they're deterministic from on high, that is saying God determines everything, they believe that although God determines everything, He has given us certain possibilities of doing good or evil things, otherwise we're not responsible, we'll be irresponsible beings. It's precisely because of this that this powerful instrument that God has given us is almost like a miraculous instrument. It's an alchemy that transforms. Simple act of forgiveness, or the acceptance of forgiveness, which purifies the soul, is given us on the basis of our free will. A forgiveness that is based on calculation is not really forgiveness. Supposing you have a fight with your neighbor over the land in between, and you say it's mine, and he says no, it's mine, and then something else happens, and you say, well, I'll forgive that man provided he gives me the ownership of this land. That is not really forgiveness. Forgiveness cannot be based on selfish interests. It has to be based on freedom, without any constraint, without any attachment. That is, the reward of forgiveness is forgiveness itself. It's not something beyond it. It's right within it. And we feel that very, very much in our lives. There's something subtle here to say that it's really the story of another day, but it should be said. Our forgiveness towards human beings, the attitude of forgiveness, must also extend to the rest of God's creation. For example, animals. In Islam, animals that are eaten are sacrificed, like in Judaism. So you have halal meat or kosher meat. In Christianity, the sacrifice of Christ for creation takes its place. But there is a feeling that we really should ask the animal its forgiveness for killing it. And in certain primal religions, like that of the Native Americans, there were explicit prayers before, let's say, the hunt of the bison or the buffalo, something like that, asking the animal forgiveness. And this attitude is in the sacrifice that is already there, the prayer that is already said. And even, sometimes I'm very sensitive to the beauty of the world of nature. I was perhaps the first person to predict the environmental crisis in the 1960s, and I've been involved in it ever since. When I see people just completely, almost unconsciously, cutting down 100-year-old trees in a forest, and then going back home and having a bottle of beer and watching a football game without any remorse of what they have done, I feel so sad what has happened to us. We should even ask pardon of the tree because we're depriving it of life. The idea of forgiveness will change our whole attitude towards the world of nature as well as other human beings. If you realize that we are not simply the owners of everything, that each thing has its right. If for a greater right, the tree has to be cut down, there's no other choice. There should be a sense of forgiveness even towards other creatures. In the mystical dimension of Islam, which is called Sufism, there are many, many stories and poems of this kind, which are really very, very beautiful. I will just tell you one story which is very famous. It was a great prince of Balkh, which is today's Afghanistan in the old Persia, called Ibrahim Atam. And his story is very much like the story of the Buddha, who was a prince and who left the palace to become the Buddha and sit on the Bodhgaya tree and become the Shakyamuni. And Ibrahim was a very handsome, powerful prince, and he used to go hunting all the time, and he thought it was his right that would take his bow and arrow and shoot beautiful gazelles and kill them. One day he saw a very, very beautiful gazelle, and he started chasing after her. And she ran, and he ran with his horse, and she ran into the forest, and he followed her. And suddenly the gazelle stopped. And with their beautiful eyes, you know, gazelle eyes are famous, looked at Ibrahim. I said, Ibrahim, I forgive you for wanting to kill me. But it's so easy to kill me. See if you can kill your own passionate soul. That is the real hunting. And Ibrahim fell off from his horse and changed his way of life completely. And he said, how can I ask forgiveness for all that I have done? And this began his spiritual life. There are many, many instances of this in all religious traditions. And I think it's quite significant for our day and age in which we are massacring the earth and hoping that we can fumble it up on television to not talk about it so we can continue to do this until the very end when we all end up dead. We need really to wake up. I'm astounded as a person who's a graduate of MIT and knows a little bit about modern science, how even now scientific arguments are snarled up by political consideration about what we're doing to the earth. It's just unbelievable. And it's practically at a time like this when the idea of forgiveness, which is a key for our survival among nations, among peoples, has really to apply it also to God's creation. Now, if it were possible to forgive all the time, it would be wonderful, but it's not. We have to deal with the question of the rights of others other than ourselves, over which we have no control. We cannot forgive if A has done something wrong to B on behalf of B. We can only forgive on behalf of ourselves. And when you have an aggregate of human beings, the question of human laws come up, the question of justice, what to do with injustice, what to do with a person who breaks the order of society, with the dangers of society, how far does forgiveness go? These are very, very complicated matters. And what we have to do is to distinguish between forgiveness as a human act, a spiritual act on behalf of ourselves, and laws of a society which are there to keep the order of society as a whole. And even at that time, to try to to keep a balance. If one goes to one extreme and says everyone who's done something wrong has to be hanged or something like that, or to the other extreme, if somebody kills somebody's neighbor, they say, oh, this is because when he was 3 years old, his father pulled his ear, and therefore let's forgive him, and back into the street he comes. Neither of these is going to work. And we see extremes of it all over the world and within American society itself from time to time. Let me tell you a personal story which is still with me after all these years. I've not lectured about forgiveness for a long time. I've not spoken about this story. In the middle 1970s, I was the president of Iran's leading scientific university, the same people who are now making the nuclear bomb in Iran, the Sharif University people. I was the president of the university. And there was a lot of commotion, the student unrest, leftist, rightist, this, that, and we had a terrible political situation like the 60s in the United States. And one day, my secretary said that an old man and his wife, the students from the villages, want to see you. I said, all right, send them in. Send them in, and they came, and a man about 70 years old and his wife, you can tell they were peasants. Simple people. And he began to cry. He said, my son is in the fourth year of college, and he's been promised a job as an engineer for 8,000 tomans a month, which is a bit over $1,100 at that time. And I only make 300 tomans a month. And you can tell them between 300 and 8,000. And the rest of it is completely innocent, is the best of people, and so forth. And mother began to cry. They appealed, actually, to the element of mercy. And I was not born to be the executioner for anyone. I'm a professor, an academician, and I hate this kind of thing. So what to do? I said, all right, I felt very, very much upset. I called up the Prime Minister. I called the Prime Minister, Mr. Oveda. I said, Mr. Oveda, such and such a person has been arrested. He said, Hossein, hold on the phone for 5 minutes, I'll get that back to you. He called up the authorities. He said, this man is a member of the Mujahideen Khadr, put a bomb, he's a terrorist, in such and such a place. He said, Hossein, this is what it is. I said, look, bring him out of prison. I take the responsibility for it. He said, if something happens, it's your fault. I said, all right, I'll take responsibility. So the next morning, they bring this young man over, standing like that, very politely. And I felt so sad for the parents. I said, look, in a few months, you're going to be able to support your whole family. They're from outside of Isfahan. And why do you do these things? He said, I didn't do anything. They arrested me by mistake. And I made him promise, I brought the Quran, made him promise in the Quran to be a good boy and not to get into politics. And I put his hand in the father's hand, the mother's hand. They cried and they thanked God and they thanked me and they left. 48 hours later, it was he who put that bomb in the Capri cinema, which killed 39 people. I've had to live with that all my life, and I'll take it to the grave with me. But this is a concrete example of forgiveness and mercy vis-a-vis law. And it's a very difficult issue. Sir John Templeton, who was one of the people who sponsored these lectures all over the United States, he was a friend of mine. He always talked about altruism and forgiveness. I said, Sir John, this is completely right, but you need also to pay attention to how to strike a balance. I think the balance that is very, very important that Islam emphasizes, not that everybody keeps to it, in the non-religion, which all the followers follow all instructions of, is that so the earth would be a paradise. But at least Islam as a religion always emphasizes, is that we have our own freedom to forgive. But we do not have the freedom to forgive for society as a whole, for others. And the laws must not be broken, the laws of God, the Sharia, in the name of forgiveness, because they protect society as a whole. There's a very interesting example of that to which I want to allude. According to Islamic law, if a person commits murder, if the family of the murdered do not consent and do not forgive, then he's put on trial and it's proven that he's committed murder, first degree murder, if it's not second degree, like in most states of the United States, he's put to death. But if the family is willing to forgive, sometimes receiving blood money, sometimes through compassion, then the murder is at least committed 1 or 2 degrees to 20 years, 25 years, something like that, and the person is not put to death. There's an interplay between forgiveness, but also the law of society. The family cannot just forgive completely, the fellow walks off as if nothing had happened, but he will not be put to death because of this element of forgiveness. There are these balances that exist, and in traditional Islamic society, in contrast to a lot of things that we see today, in name of people who think they've been very devout Muslims but are flaunting traditional Islamic values, there's always this balance that has been kept. Now, let me turn, because my time is running out quickly, and I want to give you some time to ask questions. Let me turn to a more inward aspect of forgiveness, its psychological, spiritual effect. And there's much to say about this. As I said, forgiveness, you feel it almost physically, brings with it a sense of elation, of release, of thank God I have this big monkey off my back. That's the feeling that one gets. But vis-a-vis God, forgiveness has to be always combined with repentance. In Arabic, the word for repentance is tawbah, which means to turn around. And if you want to move against God, to turn around and move towards Him. It needs a turning around. There's nothing worse than doing terrible things in the eyes of God, asking forgiveness and repentance and doing it again the next day. That gradually destroys the power of forgiveness over the soul, and one almost physically feels it. Forgiveness also is a release in the sense that it enables us to go beyond the consequences of that evil act, which involves now forgiveness. It's interesting, I'm originally a Persian, I'm Iranian. And in Persian, the word for forgiveness, besides the Arabic word maqfara, qafra, qafur, and so forth, which have entered from Arabic into Persian, is the Persian word guzasht. Guzasht, literally in Persian, means to pass by. To forgive is to pass by, let it go. Don't cling to it. Don't cling to it. Let it go and pass it by. I think it's a very, very profound etymology. Because this letting it go brings with it healing. There's always an element of healing that is combined with forgiveness. Of course, to what extent can we ask God's forgiveness and keep repeating the things which are heinous in the eyes of God and His creation? That is something very difficult for us to determine. There is an interplay, an imponderable interplay between the human and the divine, between our actions and God's mercy, between forgiveness. And it would be, I think, very wrong to try to set rules for this. One cannot set limits upon God's mercy, and one cannot even set limits upon God's creatures. Sometimes the person who holds a grudge for 40 years suddenly becomes someone else, and someone whom you would never expect to give forgiveness for gifts. And someone who would have not accepted forgiveness from someone else because of haughtiness, pride, being hurt, whatever it is, suddenly things change. There is this, as I said, as long as we're alive, life. To be alive means to have life, and life implies different states, growth, coming and going. It is not something that is barren or consolidated and mortified and dead. It means something that is alive. There's always the possibility of events related to forgiveness which are unforeseen. The important thing is that, first of all, we should never set a limit to God's forgiveness. We should always ask His forgiveness no matter what. Secondly, we should always pray for those who do something against us and try to forgive them. But the best way to do that is to leave it in God's hands. Do not take revenge upon our own hands. And it's something very difficult, but one has to try to practice it. And thirdly, not to be so haughty as to reject the proposal of someone who asks forgiveness. There's no excuse for that. That also one should leave in one's hands. There is in Islam the danger that you also have in Christianity, in Judaism, of self-righteousness. Those who would put a limit on all these three steps of forgiveness. Remember Christ, when they were going to stone the adulteress, they said, "He who has not committed any sin, cast the first stone." And that stopped everybody. Christ was trying to teach a lesson against the self-righteousness, which unfortunately gets into society very quickly, and we become all good, and the other side becomes all bad, and the door of forgiveness is suddenly shut, and contentions begin. If all humanity could reach a spiritual state in which human beings would forgive each other for the shortcomings, for what they've done, of course we'll all be living in paradise. But evil does exist in this world. That's not going to happen like that. But there's nevertheless, this is an ideal that has to be remembered. Let me conclude with two points, because not always does someone speak about Islam here for you. Other religions probably are spoken of more often. There is, according to a saying of the Prophet, underneath the throne of God, written this Arabic sentence, Inna rahmati sabaqa ghadabi. That is, verily my mercy comes before my wrath, precedes my wrath. There is such a thing as divine wrath. I know it's not fashionable now, even in religious circles, especially in Protestants, who talk about divine wrath. But nevertheless, there is such a thing as divine wrath. But the divine mercy comes before that. And it's that divine mercy that is the source of all things. Secondly, I want to quote this Persian poem for you by one of the greatest Sufi poets, Fariduddin Attar, about the question of prejudging who is forgiven and who is not as human beings. He says, "Kedanat ta be ma'ni muttaqikist, sa'id az ma kudam asto sharikist." Who knows among us who is reverent towards God? Who among us knows the person who has committed sin and the person who has been forgiven and has gained happiness? That is, to have a humility in this matter is very, very important. It's amazing how we lack that in our day and age, even among many people who consider themselves to be pious. Now, my last word is somewhat inward and esoteric, but I want to conclude with that. Islam believes that the prophets of God, all the 124,000 from Adam to the Prophet of Islam, are inerrant, ma'asum. I do not use the word infallible, because that's a specifically Catholic term used for the infallibility of the Pope when he speaks ex cathedra. That's since 19th century part of Catholic doctrine. But inerrant, that means God prevents his prophets from making an error, from committing sin, transgression. They are saved from transgression. But the Prophet of Islam, every day of his life, until the day he died, would invoke, according to some 99 times, according to some 70 times, Astaghfirullah, Astaghfirullah, Astaghfirullah. I ask God's forgiveness. I ask pardon from God. Why in the world was this man doing this? What did he have to ask God pardon for? What should God forgive him for? He had not committed any sin, he just followed divine command. This has, as it says, a very subtle meaning, and that is the following. To exist separately from God, to separate oneself and one's consciousness from God, is already to commit the first of all sins, sin of separation. The fall from paradise symbolizes that. And as long as we are human beings, we need to overcome that first of all sins, which is the sin of separation from God, from which comes forgetfulness, and forgetfulness comes all concupiscence, transgression, all that we do against God's laws and against the welfare of humanity. And therefore, the famous saying, which is by a woman saint of early Islam, thy existence is a sin according to which no sin can be compared. Wujudaka dhanbun la yuqasu bihi adhan. This is really the key for the understanding of why a man like the Prophet of Islam prayed to God for forgiveness. To be human is to be able to slip down the slope, to make mistakes. And so the attitude of asking forgiveness of God should always be there for human beings, and the attitude of forgiving others and also accepting their forgiveness should be, in a humble way, our way of participating in this remarkable